Hi, Dave Emmer here. This is For the Record program number 1337. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 11. This is being recorded on July 27th of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to reintroduce to the audience my new co-host, Monty. And, things are developing apace, you know, this is conversation number 11. But before we get into the actual subject material, this has been a news intensive week. I mean, I read in today's Western print edition of the New York Times, there was some sort of sabotage of the French high speed rail system or something, not in Paris proper. What do you want to bet that gets blamed on Russia? I mean, at a certain point, you've seen all these movies before, and you kind of know how they're going to end. And now, you know, several years ago, I was saying on the air that Joe Biden is brain damaged. You know, he can't talk. And I guess he overcame a stutter as a young man. And so people were, there was X amount of pushback on the internet about that. The Pacifica Evening News, when he met with President Xi Jinping of China in, I think it was Woodside, one of the Tony communities on the peninsula, he gave an address and he couldn't talk. I mean, he was slurring his words. I mean, it was really shocking. And now, you know, he stepped down, and we're going to see. We've got, I'm scared, and I feel for the young people, because they just don't, they didn't ask for this, you know, they did not ask for this, but, here we go. Forward into the past is what we're going to be doing. However, those are some of my ruminations on what has happened in the past week. Monty, you are going to be treating us, and in this regard, I view myself as not only a de facto member of the audience, but very humbly a student of the research that you are unpacking for us. And so with that characteristically verbose introduction, why don't you begin presenting what you are going to be showing us today?
Well, Dave, once again, it's a genuine privilege to be here on your program. Today, I wanted to present a continuity, as it were, of some of the stay-behind elements. And I'm sure that veteran listeners of your program will know what I'm referencing. The covert armies that were developed in the post-World War II environment, mostly of a fascist cadre or ilk, that were meant to be some kind of a home guard or rear guard action, as it were, against a potential Soviet invasion of the Western orbit, which, obviously never happened. But
by the way, let me butt in briefly. Was apparently a U.S. Army study done, long after the Cold War, I think it became public in 2017. And this is not news to people who are familiar. The Soviet Union never intended an invasion of Western Europe. I mean, it was simply an excuse to create these stay-behind networks. And I feel maybe if this is an unfair overstatement on my part, please put me in my place. But what they were really doing was resuscitating covertly the very fascists that they had supported prior to and during World War II, and whom they could not wait to rearm and reorganize against ostensibly the Soviet Union, but really, I think, democratic elements with a small d in their own country, particularly if it was perceived as being possible that democracy could yield a socialist or quote Marxist unquote government, as appeared to have been the case in Italy for some time, or if they were entering into a parliamentary coalition.
Right. Yes. I would have to agree with all of those positions, especially the one of a parliamentary coalition, which is essentially what is happening, small d democracy here in the United States. And for the edification of your audience, you and I have had several conversations about the idea, of how absurd it is that these stay-behind armies were being developed in every single NATO country except the United States. You know, why don't we see a presence of a stay-behind Gladio-esque army here in the United States? And the gist of today's program, and in all likelihood it will extend it to further programs, I would like to present that there was, in fact, a Gladio stay-behind army here in the United States developed ostensibly through the anti-Castro milieu, specifically at a building which is, once again, I'm sure known to veteran listeners of your program, based at 544 Camp Street in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I am of the opinion, and this will be the information I'll be presenting today, that William Guy Bannister's detective agency, Guy Bannister Associates, in 1962, was the nerve center of a domestic Gladio network that included elements of the far right, specifically, and I will demonstrate this, specifically, elements of, oh, what can I say? Everything from the Central Intelligence Agency to the FBI, to at that time the American Security Council, and what can I say? All points in between, the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, the Defenders of American Liberties, the Louisiana State Sovereignty Commission, the Pioneer Fund, elements of the Young Americans for Freedom, and even elements behind Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign.
And by the way, I would add to that National States' Rights Party, Minutemen, American Nazi Party, Ku Klux Klan, elements of what are viewed as domestic fascists, but are sanitized so that their obvious connections to the intelligence community are not formally acknowledged, even sadly by a lot of JFK researchers. And in that regard, before you proceed, remember in the James, was it James Caulfield, about who wrote that huge volume about General Edwin Walker?
Correct,
And
correct.
it's a very good book, a very useful book, but it has to be handicapped because he goes out of his way to say, no, the intelligence community wasn't involved, but, you know, Nazis, National States' Rights Party, Minutemen, et cetera, all of the elements which I think you're going to be discussing, were involved. And remember in that book, there was a very telling statement by Glenn Pinchback, who was part of the operations command at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And he was communicating with Jim Garrison, the New Orleans DA, who was investigating JFK's assassination. And I think in many ways, this is the epitaph for American, you know, democracy, unquote.
Oh, absolutely.
But where he said that he had uncovered a Nazi plot gargantuan in scope to enslave America in the name of anti-communism. Because we think, well, we have anti-communism, yeah, sure. That was a gambit to basically eliminate not only American democracy, but a lot of the people who support it. Monty, continue.
Of course. I'd like to turn your listening audience's attention to a man by the name of William Frank Buckley Jr., who in 1963 helped create a steering committee that eventually became the modern day Young Americans for Freedom. And ultimately, what astounds me is that when you examine this steering committee, there are overt through and through Gladio connected, you know, bear that in mind, your listening audience, Gladio connected stay behind army elements that are related to this organizational structure that eventually became the Young Americans for Freedom. And one of the most overt connections that I found in my research, trying to correlate all of these, I think you termed it as a shattered mirror of resources that I've been trying to put together, within the Young Americans for Freedom. And I should note, In the context of the Kennedy assassination, there was a series of leaflets that were actually dropped on Dallas, Texas, before President Kennedy showed up in Redbird Airfield that morning of the 22nd November 1963, that were labeled "Welcome to Dallas, Mr. Kennedy." Right?
Is that actually Love Field? Redbird was at the airport.
Oh, excuse me, Love Field. Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah, Love Field.
Yep.
And ultimately, this "Welcome to Dallas, Mr. Kennedy" ad, what was in fact a Psy warfare publication that was meant to terrorize and intimidate the incoming Kennedy procession. So it accused President Kennedy of being a communist agitator, selling out China and Africa to the Soviets and the Chinese, not supporting the anti-Castro element, making secret deals with Tito and Hungarian communists, not to mention a very interesting input in that ad, or I should say side of intrigue in that ad, is a reference to the PCI, the Italian Communist Party, claiming that President Kennedy had been financing them. So this ad that was dropped literally by plane, leafleted onto the streets of Dallas on the day that President Kennedy was assassinated, was published by the Young Americans for Freedom. So bear that in mind. In 1960,
I have a question about it. Now, was the crafting of that leaflet and the dropping of them on Dallas, was that linked to the ad in the Dallas Morning News, accusing President Kennedy of treason?
No, that was in fact something else, which I will get to later on in this program. That was actually orchestrated by a man by the name of Larry Schmidt and Robert Surrey. And those two men, as I shall reveal later on in the program, were in fact military intelligence agents working for Headquarters Division, Southern Command, United States Army out of Munich, under General Reinhard Galen and General Edwin Walker. But we'll get to that later in the program.
And Surrey, as I recall, also was a member of the American Nazi Party.
Absolutely. He was a member of the American Nazi Party, specifically Roy Frankhauser's wing of the American Nazi Party, under something called the Klan Bureau of Investigation, or the KBI, which was the intelligence arm of the Ku Klux Klan, controlled by a man by the name of Eugene Tabbutt, last name spelled T-A-B-B-U-A-T-T. And Roy Frankhauser was one of his lieutenants in that time period.
Go ahead, Marty. Proceed, please.
With William F. Buckley's direct connections to Gladio and this Psy warfare leaflet that was dropped on Dallas, I'd like to quote from Professor Jeffrey M. Bale's book, The Darkest Sides of Politics, Part 1, subtitled Postwar Fascism, Covert Operations, and Terrorism.
I just want to interrupt briefly. Jeffrey Bale has done some superb work. He has sadly not been presented to this audience, and I'm very pleased that perhaps belatedly we will be giving Professor Bale his due, or at least part of it, in this program. Proceed.
Sure. The following quote can be found on page 207 of the book, and this is actually in the notes section for chapter 3, okay? So you're not going to find this in the main body of the chapter. This is from the notes section on page 207, and the chapter, incidentally, is called Postwar Neo-Fascist Internationals, Part 2, Agentur Press and the Strategy of Tension in Italy. And I'll just quote it in its entirety if you don't mind, Dave.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, quote, Parvaluskios involvement in international anti-communist networks is also revealed by his own correspondence. I should note that Parvaluskio was a member of the New Order brigades that were set up by Julius Evola in the post-World War II environment. Continuing, quote, for example, in a 10 May 1962 letter to James Burnham, the former American Trotskyite turned anti-communist, who thereafter became involved in many covert projects during the Cold War, Parvaluskio identified himself as chief of the external apparatus of a Europe and Latin American-based organization called Organisation de l'Armée Secrète Charlemagne, which, according...
So that would be the secret army of the Order of Charlemagne.
Correct.
Okay, go ahead.
Which, according to that same organization's 23 April 1962 intelligence report, also sent Burnham by Parvaluskio, claimed to represent, quote, European, Catholic, and social revolutionary current, end quote, within the OAS. So real quick, this is a covert operation that has grafted itself to the French secret army organization. So think of it like a paramilitary command structure that existed within a terrorist organization. So a secret entity within another secret organization.
The OAS, by the way, stands for l'Organisation de l'Armée Secrète. It was basically a French fascist group that sought to eliminate de Gaulle because of his willingness to grant independence to Algeria, and this also had support from Reinhard Gehlen.
Correct. Direct support, which I'll get to in a few moments. Continuing with Bale, this OAS Charlemagne organization claimed to represent the European Catholic and Social Revolutionary Current within the OAS, currently opposed to the General Salan Garde faction. So this is a splinter group that is opposed to General Salan's capitulation to Charles de Gaulle. In his letter, Pavel Lescano suggested that Burnham collaborate with OAS Charlemagne Group and urged Americans to meet with him in Madrid, where Pavel Lescano had lived, the next time he was in Europe. After the meeting, an American reprimanded by reading again. After the meeting, an American recommended by Burnham in Spain, Robert Manili, using this using the pseudonym Paris André Mada, and I should give the spelling on his last name. Manili is spelled M-I-N-E-L-L-I, and purportedly he is a United States Army Green Beret. Continuing. Reading again. After a meeting with an American recommended by Burnham in Spain, Robert Manili, Parvalusco, using the pseudonym Paris André Madan, wrote Burnham another letter dated 2 June 1962, in which he revealed that the OAS Charlemagne group was only the visible tip of another group later identified by Guido Gianetti. AMSAR, spelling on that is A-M-S-A-R, AMSAR, itself comprised of an external apparatus and an internal apparatus and an intelligence apparatus called the Direction Générale en Conjoncture à l'Antarctique, or the DGCA, in English roughly translates to the Directorate General of Atlantic Conjecture, a name which clearly reveals its Atlantis geopolitical orientation. I should note that Cuba is in the Atlantic. Continuing. And the only reason I mention that is, as I alluded to earlier, I'm going to prove that this organization had direct connections with the anti-Castro effort. Continuing. Indeed, Pavel Escor argued in his second letter that a united Atlantic community was alone capable of saving the West at this moment of crisis. AMSAR, therefore, hoped to undertake intelligence and other types of operations in cooperation with NATO, okay, including operations behind the Iron Curtain. Finally, on 3 June 1962 letter written to William F. Buckley, Jr., editor of the National Review, Manda indicated that Guido Gianetti was his organization's chief in Italy, and that the Italian would henceforth be contacting Buckley using the pseudonym Margarine Levain. All of these French language documents can be found in the Hoover Institution archive files under James Burnham, collection box 10, folder subject file number 5, OAS Charlemagne, end quote. I mean, what's to be said here, Mr. Emery? The way I unpack this is that this is proof positive that William F. Buckley, as he's creating the Young Americans for Freedom, this is a time period of 1962-1963, was in direct contact with Jean Pavel Lescor, the chief of all covert actions of this OAS Charlemagne organization that is ostensibly operating in exile in Italy, and that its primary commander was Guido Gianetti, who's working under the umbrella of an even more covert organization called AMSAR, the Director General of Atlantic Conjecture.
You know, just want to interject very briefly. An indication of how fundamentally perverted our political slash intellectual culture is William F. Buckley has achieved a reputation as being a quote moderate unquote Republican. And it with the information that you have presented already and that I'm sure you are going to further develop, it's like talking about somebody as being a moderate Nazi. I mean, it is surreal, but go ahead, Monty.
Well, this seen through the focal lens of the assassination of President Kennedy, 100%. I mean, labeling William F. Buckley as a moderate Republican is just absurd to the extent that it's ludicrous. I mean, it's absolute insanity. I mean, here we have him, for all intents and practical purposes, in direct contact in 1962, 1963 time period with the literal revolutionary founder of Operation Gladio.
And now, again, it's surreal. And to take things forward ever so briefly,
that
fundamental absurdity could, in a sense, be viewed as the wellspring of a perverted political culture that now in 2024, you've got Donald Trump, who was married to his first wife, Ivana, by Norman Vincent Peale, who, is cited in the book Undercover, available on my website and also on the flash drive that's available. He served as a front for Edward James Looney, a charter member of the American Nazi Party prior to and during World War II. And that very same first wife, Ivana, stated that Trump kept a copy of Hitler's speeches called My New Order, published as a sequel to Mein Kampf, in his nightstand for late-night reading. Of course, Ivana wasn't able to give any perspective on the January 6th hearings because she conveniently died in the middle of that, ostensibly from falling down a flight of stairs and receiving a contusion on her chest that was fatal. And then Donald Trump, I guess he buried her in one of his golf courses to get a tax break. So that's maybe a grim manifestation of a hole in one.
Well, I mean, what's to be said? I mean, I would have to agree with that wholeheartedly, and it's very disturbing, but there it is.
And this is a guy whose attorneys argued in a federal appellate court before federal judges that if Trump, as a seated president, ordered SEAL Team 6 to murder a political rival, that he would be immune from prosecution for that. So when we are talking about things in the past, people should understand that where we have gotten to is it's rather like a sort of fascist garden where the seeds were planted, they were watered, they grew, and now we've got this. Go ahead, Mavi.
Right. Going back to Buckley and his connections to Guido Gianetti and this Jean Pravoloscur, the head of covert operations for this OAS Charlemagne organization in 62. As I pointed out in previous programs, and as you have pointed out in your programs, going all the way back to the anti-fascist archives programs you were doing in the 80s, Dave, it should be noted that William F. Buckley Jr. at one point in 1955 was an operational agent of the CIA in Mexico City, and his immediate supervisor was none other than Everett Howard Hunt Jr., who at that time in 1962 was he had just come off of a stint as the chief of covert operations for the anti-Castro effort. Ho-ho!
Which also places Watergate in a very interesting light as well. Continue, Monty.
Right. In terms, and I don't know what to make of this, but I'm just going to share this information with your listening audience, and perhaps somebody that's a bit more enlightened and has better resources than I can figure this out. But I don't know, really, who directly publishes the Welcome to Dallas, Mr. Kennedy ad, other than it is a Young Americans for Freedom publication. But I think it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating, that E. Howard Hunt's job in 1963 in the CIA is this. His full title is Chief of Domestic Operations Division, research and publications staff. That's fascinating, because that means that he was the chief of all domestic, read into that, United States of America, domestic CIA covert operations that had to do with propaganda publications. And the fact that William F. Buckley's Young Americans for Freedom published that Welcome to Dallas, Mr. Kennedy ad is fascinating, in the sense that E. Howard Hunt would have been the authorizing arm of the CIA that was publishing propaganda of a far right ilk. So, you know, I'll just let that fester with your listening audience. Continuing, the other man that's mentioned in the correspondence with the Charlemagne OSS is James Burnham, who himself was a founder of the far-right National Review magazine, of which William F. Buckley was a central player and editor of for several years. But beyond that, Burnham was one of the creators of the stay-behind forces in Germany, specifically the Austrian branch of the stay-behind armies. And as such, he was the commander in 1948 of the State Department's Office of Policy Coordination, Political and Psychological Warfare staff. Burnham also was co-founder of the, quite literally, the CIA's money laundering front organization called the Congress of Cultural Freedom, where his deputy was a CIA covert action chief by the name of Thomas Wardell Braden. So essentially, James Burnham oversaw early on with the CIA, 1948 onwards, the bulk of their political and psychological warfare programs. And here he is with William F. Buckley in 1962 in direct contact with Gladio and Charlemagne OAS terrorists. Beyond that, it should be noted that James Burnham's counterpart, and this is in keeping with the spirit of the conversations that we've been having about the Kennedy assassination and some of the larger parapolitical aspects of it, it should also be noted that James Burnham's counterpart in 1948 within the Psychological Strategy Board, and later on its predecessor, the Operations Coordinating Board, which were sub-entities of the National Security Council, his counterpart within the Psychological Strategy Board was a United States Army general by the name of Charles Douglas Jackson, who, of course, was in 1963, the top editor of Time Life magazine and the man that acquired the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination and kept it under lock and key until James Erling Crothers Garrison, Big Jim Garrison, the district attorney of Orleans Parish, subpoenaed Time Life for copies of that film. So consider the phalanx between, you know, Charles Douglas Jackson, Thomas Wardell Braden, James Burnham, William F. Buckley, E. Howard Hunt, and the anti-Castro effort, and the entire command of Operation Gladio under Guido Gianetti that exists in 1963. This is an active, covert operation that is transatlantic in nature, that includes the worst of the worst of the American far right, and what can I say, mass murdering fascists that are active in Europe in this time period. This is an active covert operation network that has no name, no face, but is transatlantic in nature, seemingly embedded within the anti-Castro effort.
A question, Bobby. Now, Guido Gianetti, is that by any chance Guido Giannettini? Because he was a guy.
Oh, excuse me, Guido Giannettini.
Wonderful. I mean, not wonderful, but oy vey, as they would say in Yiddish. But there are other things I would say, but I can't say them on the air because
I'm reading a very, very poor interpretation. Yeah, that's actually his name. Yes.
Guido Giannettini was a member of the P2, and
right.
He also was lecturing to, I think it was cadets of Annapolis in 1963. And
correct. Actually, 1961, he's lecturing at cadets at Annapolis. Actually, on the request of the chief of the cadet personnel staff at Annapolis, which is a lieutenant general by the name of Pedro Del Valle.
that assassin, but Guido Giannettini was part of the whole P2 nexus and is discussed in, I think it is AFA, either 18 or 19, part of the massive five-part AFA series on the shooting of the Pope.
Yeah, let me get the correct spelling on here. His last name's Giannettini. That's the correct spelling here. Giannettini. Yes. This is the man that's in direct liaison of William F. Buckley in 1962 as he's creating the Young Americans for Freedom organization.
There's so many things that come to mind. I mean, if this is what freedom is, I hate to see totalitarianism, but sweet creeping Jesus. This is so amazing. It's not amazing, but when one exists, the late author Norman Mailer observed that in the age of intelligence, and he didn't mean intellect, but in the age of espionage, every truth is obliged to live in the presence of its denial. And if William F. Buckley is a moderate Republican, you know, it's like saying, yeah, well, I don't know, Max Egan von Hohenlohe was a moderate Nazi. You know, I mean, it's surreal. It's absolutely surreal. Please continue.
Putting this in sort of a future tense connection and talking about these stay behind elements that are directly connected to the anti-Castro effort through William F. Buckley and his Young Americans for Freedom, and of course, E. Howard Hunt. And I should note that the connection between Buckley and Hunt isn't just professional. E. Howard Hunt is godfather to all of William F. Buckley's children. I mean, that's how intimate they are. So in talking about its connections to the big event, as it were, in Dallas, I'd like to once again quote from Professor Jeffrey Bale's book, The Darkest Sides of Politics, once again from Chapter 3. And this is a reference that can be found in page 120. And also in the reference section, page 120 of chapter 3, the same chapter I referenced before, which is called Postwar Neo-Fascist Internationals, part 1, Nazi Escape Networks, the Social European Movement, the European New Order, and the Junie Europe Movement. And if I may, I'll quote it in its entirety.
Sure, go ahead. Young Europe, right?
Yeah, Young Europe Organization, yeah.
Go ahead.
Quote, reference number 66. Once again, I'm looking at the reference section of this book. Reference 66. For information about Merrick's, see Heinz Wieland's Waffenschmuggel in Staffengrad and Langborn Graham Wilhelm Busset, which was published by Bus Seafahrt Press, Hartford, in 1986. A book, Beast Reawakens by Lee, referenced in pages 183 and 4. Incidentally, Lee claims that Otto Skorzeny helped found the company Merrick's AG, in addition to doing business with an ex-CIA officer by the name of Samuel Cummings, InterArms Corporation, and he became a major weapons broker for the Salazar regime. That's the fascist regime in Portugal in 1963.
As I recall, too, eventually Merrick's was surfaced as a BND front. And I'm trying to remember the name of the former German paratrooper who...
Mertens.
Gerhard
Grigor Mertens, a captain in the Fallschirmjäger, the parachute regimes of the Wehrmacht. He was actually the revolutionary mind behind the raid that frees... Mussolini,
wow.
Correct. So a lot of people attribute that to Otto Skorzeny. Otto Skorzeny was not the man that came up with the plans for that raid. It was actually a Captain Gerhard Mertens. But continuing with the account by Jeffrey Bale, talking about, you know, who exactly is behind Mertens and how this relates to the Gladio armies. And in here, there is a quote from a 13 September 1975 telegram prepared by an official of the Portuguese embassy in Paris that details the concerns of a man by the name of Spinola and his contacts in Italy. I should note that the Spinola that they're referencing is a man by the name of Antonio Di Spinola, who was the head of President Solon's, or excuse me, I'm reading again, General Anton Spinola, who was the head of the Portuguese counter-revolutionary army that created the ELP in 1967, which was a pro-fascist gladio-type army that was created under Salazar's regime. So, continuing with this account, and some of the people that General Antonio Salona was in contact with in 1975. So this is
One note I want to interject briefly, because again, a lot of listeners are younger. But
sure.
Mr. Salazar, was his first name Enrique or Antonio? I've forgotten off the top of my head.
Antonio Salazar.
Yep. It is pretty well known, or relatively well known, that Spain under Francisco Franco was a fascist country. So was Portugal under Salazar. So you have the entire Iberian Peninsula, ostensibly, quote, neutral, unquote, during World War II, but firmly in the fascist camp. And that, as the connections that you're presenting to us develop, that's something that should be borne in mind. Continue.
Right. So once again, this is a telegram that was prepared by an official at the Portuguese embassy in Paris concerning the details of General Antonio Spinola's contacts in 13 September 1975. Quote, among other persons whom Spinola supposedly met with in his summer visits to several European countries were Franz Josef Straub of the Bavarian Christian Social Union, Sanchez Cosavia of the GCR, billionaire Rihor Yahim, the ex-Secretary of State of Salazar and a key financial backer of the anti-independence organizations in Mozambique and other Portuguese colonies, Hermann Josef Abs of Krupp, previously the head of Deutsche Bank under the Nazi regime, leaders of the ELP, John McCone, formerly director of the CIA, and at that time in 1975, director of the International Telephone and Telegraph Company, where he previously played a role in anti-Allende subversion in Chile. Several CIA officials were in contact with General Spinola, including Adjutant Lieutenant General Vernon A. Walters, then Deputy Director of the CIA, and representatives from a number of other multinational companies, including arms trafficking firms, to include Belgium's Societe Generale Pinorfina, ELF, a French oil company that was deeply implicated in the so-called sniffer plane scandal, MGM, an arms trading company in Modena that the Italian judge Luciano Valatet believed was linked to members associated with Fronte Nazionale, or National Front, the organizational backbone of the December 1970 Borghese coup, and Permandex, an alleged Swiss-based CIA proprietary company operating in South Africa in 1975. End quote. Now,
And Permandex had previously been very active in Italy, but was booted out. It figures obliquely in the director's cut of the movie JFK by Oliver Stone, because one of the people involved with Permandex overlapped Centro Mondiale Commerciale, and that was one of the organizations that Clay Shaw was involved with.
correct, correct. Bear this in mind, though. I'm quoting from a diplomatic cable from 13 September 1975, and Permandex is still an entity active in direct communique with Hermann Abs and John McCone.
Hermann Abs, of course, was chairman of the Deutsche Bank, one of the Third Reich's most important, if not the most important banker. And eventually, when the Vatican banking scandals broke, who should get called in by Pope John Paul II to, quote, straighten things out, unquote, but that very same Hermann Abs. So that is a fascinating thing. And John McCone was head of the CIA when Kennedy was killed. He also was working in a security capacity for Ronald Reagan's gubernatorial campaign when he defeated Pat Brown in 1966.
That's correct. Well, what's to be said? You know, they got a little robin's nest of fascists there surrounding Ronald Reagan. But continuing with this narrative. Now, why do I bring this up? Why do I bring up this information concerning General Antonio Spinola's connections to Permandex and John McCone in 1975? Well, as a point of fact, the man who was operating in Portugal in 1962, working directly with OAS fascists, is General Antonio Spinola. And he's working directly with the OAS Charlemagne elements that are behind the machinations of the Young Americans for Freedom with William F. Buckley. I should pivot backwards a little bit, even further into the history of what the OAS represents. And I'd like to quote directly on an intellectual level what exactly the concern of terrorism is and what it represents for the Kennedy assassination. And this comes from a book called The Techniques of Revolutionary Fascism. And it was published in 1963, excuse me, in 1963 by Guido Gianettini.
Gianettini, fascinating.
Gianettini. And this was published in 1963. Quote, and this is a direct quote from his book, which was a technical manual for revolutionary fascism. Quote, as far as terrorism is concerned, it should be specific that it can be of two types, indiscriminate terrorism and selective terrorism. The first involves making bombs that explode in public offices and locales, in streets and gatherings of crowds, or randomly shooting down people with firearms. In contrast, selective terrorism is carried out by eliminating certain carefully selected persons for a variety of reasons, either because that person could be of use of the enemy, or because their death would paralyze or impede the adversary's organizational machine, or because being moderates or moderators, they would inhibit the other side from intensifying the struggle, or finally because their elimination would provoke harsh retaliations that would further increase tension, creating an irreversible phenomena that would lead to civil war. End quote.
By the way, I just want to interrupt ever so briefly, Marvin. We don't have time to go into details, but as the absurdities surrounding the security situation in Butler, Pennsylvania, at which a Trump rally resulted in Trump being shot in the ear. JFK was not shot in the ear. It just, Parafractal has set forth some remarkable material, as did another listener. And I think that the shooting of Trump might very well have been intended to provoke exactly such a thing. Alex Jones had advocated for something like that on his InfoWars program. And Kevin Roberts, who I believe is with the Heritage Foundation and part of the Project 2025 milieu, was also talking about, you know, quote, the left, unquote. Marjorie Taylor Greene was talking about the left wanted this. I mean, if the Democrats are the left, then, you know, I'm the scarecrow in the Wizard of Oz, as my late dear friend Mae Bussell would have said, you know, oh, my Aiken, A blank blank, you know, but I wonder very much. I'm really, really pleased that you just shared that excerpt from Guido Gianettini's, ideological tract, because I think that has strong resonance with what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania. There is no way that what we are told happened could have happened unless, fascists within the Secret Service and others were deliberately trying to provoke something like that. Thank you, Marty. Please proceed.
Absolutely. And I thank you so much for bringing this forward, because I'm absolutely, on a personal level, nauseated with the narrative that we've been given about that. And what I know about, without revealing too much about my background, with what I know about protecting VIPs in combat in Afghanistan as being a combat veteran of those operations, I can count off at least 19 failures of the Secret Service in protecting Mr. Trump. Not that I have any sympathies for the man, but there it is. And I do not understand how this could not be seen as other than a false flag in order to militarize elements of the far right.
Absolutely. I think that was the beginning or the signal for a major right wing, ha. There's the conditioning, even myself, fascist, domestic fascist bloodletting that is in the immediate offing.
Right. So continuing with the narrative I've been developing, and I'd like to backpedal a little bit. So I've mentioned the OAS Charlemagne connections to William F. Buckley and Burnham. I've talked about the Permandex, active Permandex connection to John McCone and General Antonio Spinola operating in Portugal in 1975, that this is, in fact, a milieu that is active. I'd like to bring it full circle to who are the forces behind the OAS, meaning the secret army organization that was created to murder Charles de Gaulle over his anti-imperialist concessions in Algeria and Indochina. Once again, I'd like to quote directly from Jeffrey Bale's Darkest Sides of Politics, Part 1. This is from the main body of the book, not the reference section. Once again, from Chapter 3. This is pages 76 and 78 of the book. Once again, Chapter 3, titled Post-War Neo-Fascist Internationals, Part 1, Nazi Escape Networks, the Movement of Social Yerepané, the New Order European Movement, and the UNE Europe, Young Europe Movement. And if I may, I'll quote its entirety, Dave.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, quote, from this point on, certain factions of U.S. intelligence appear to have secretly protected Skorzeny in order to make special use of his specialized abilities, unbeknownst to other Allied security personnel without a need to know, who tried to track his movements and prevent him from engaging in anti-democratic actions. This was a pattern, a general pattern, that has now been aptly documented in cases of many high-profile Nazi figures, such as Klaus Barbie, Alois Brunner, and Friedrich Schrend. In this case, the protective group issued a warning to their famous prisoner, who was then supposed to be writing an account of Mussolini's rescue for the United States Army Historical Division, to the effect that continued Czechoslovakian demands for his extradition could not be ignored or delayed indefinitely. In all probability, they then facilitated his escape to Darmstadt Detention Center, providing American military police uniforms for three former SS men who were thereby able to dupe the German camp guards into releasing him into their custody. After a period of general confusion in which his whereabouts were only known to those who were actively involved in sheltering him, unsubstantiated stories appeared in the press which claimed that Skorzeny had been flown to an American base in Georgia. In all likelihood, and this is my own editorial note, that base is probably Fort Benning, Georgia, which is the home of the United States Army Infantry Branch. Continuing. Skorzeny had been flown to an American base in Georgia to help train U.S. Army paratroopers. In 1950, he was definitely spotted in Paris, where politically motivated rumors were circulated that he was engaged in gathering information about the French Communist Party, Parti Communiste Francois, or the PCF. However propagandistic these specific claims may appear, report prepared by the 66th United States Army Counterintelligence Corps group admitted that he might have been working for the United States intelligence since his escape from prison. Another report from the 7970 Counterintelligence Group suggested that he may have been aided by Americans during his subsequent flight from France to his secret reentry into West Germany. There is no doubt, moreover, that the Anglo-American intelligence personnel kept him under regular observation after he settled in Spain, because those outside of the information loop did not know those affiliated with the latter were not entirely certain that he could be trusted. Indeed, in 1951, Skorzeny approached an American military Air Force attaché in Madrid and offered to recruit German veterans into an anti-communist guerrilla unit capable of fighting behind enemy lines should the Soviets invade Western Europe. Although this particular proposal was turned down, perhaps because the United States was already setting up their own stay-behind groups throughout non-communist Europe, Skorzeny was at some point recruited as a contract agent by Reinhard Gehlen, a convenient arrangement that provided the Americans with a degree of, quote, plausible deniability, end quote, had anybody asked if they were making use of his services themselves. It was in part due to these very intelligence contacts that Skorzeny became actively involved in a number of terrorist and covert operations over the course of the next 20 years.
And by the way, very, very quickly, I want to give a plug for the book Coup in Dallas by the late Hank Albarelli. It is a very important book that links the milieu you're talking about with the assassination of JFK. I just want to give a caveat. The book is very poorly edited, and there are some really juvenile editorial mistakes in there. It's very sad, but it is an important book, albeit an editorially very flawed book, that links
right.
us also talked about the links, the attempts on de Gaulle's life and the links to JFK's assassination in For the Record 1161, and then in For the Record 422, 23, 24, and I think 25, I talked about coup in Dallas and linked that whole milieu, my favorite word, with the very milieu you're talking about right now. Go ahead.
Of course. Continuing. Some of these operations deserve to be highlighted because they provide a good illustration of the post-war utilization of European right-wing extremists by elements of Western intelligence. Among other things, Skorzeny purportedly trained personnel for the Argentine secret police and the Buenos Aires police in torture and interrogation techniques during his periodic stays with Juan and Evita Perón prior to the dictator's 1955 ouster and flight to Spain. In late 1952, in response to a request from Jamal Abdul al-Nasser, CIA chief Alan Dulles turned to Galen for help in recruiting personnel to train the Egyptian intelligence service and security services. With Hymar Horace Greeley Schultz's help, Reinhard Galen persuaded Skorzeny to take the job after assuring him that his salary would be paid for by al-Nasir and would be supplemented fully by CIA funds laundered through the Galen organization.
And by the way, Gamal Abdel Nasser was the president of Egypt, the primary figure of the Pan-Arabist movement, and like one of his successors, Anwar Sadat, he was actually a Nazi spy during World War II. Colonial era overlaps the area of the era of the rise of fascism, and some of the most important fascist movements actually had their genesis in some of the anti-colonial struggles, and they saw fascism as a way of getting rid of the British, the French, whoever. Please continue, Martin. We've got about 6 minutes left.
Of course. So it was that the Austrians spent a total of 18 months recruiting 100 German advisors from the SS underground and neo-fascist outfits. And more suspect sources claim that he also trained Arab guerrillas in commando tactics and protected some of the ex-Nazi technicians working for al-Nasir from Israeli hit teams. Furthermore, Scarface may have secretly met with 3 CIA officials and 2 West Germans, a Spaniard, and 3 French military officers in Madrid on 12 April 1961. Among these Frenchmen were 2 experienced soldiers who were to later play a key part in the organization the Armée Secrète Charlemagne. General Paul Gardet, formerly the Inspector General of the Légion Amagrette, or the Foreign Legion in Algiers, and Gardet Révolutionnaire Colonel Jean Gardez, the most highly decorated officer in the French army between 1944 and 1945, who eventually was the commander of the 5th Psychological Warfare Bureau in Algeria. Whether Skorzeny thereafter kept in contact and provided operational logistic assistance to elements of the OAS, as communist sources claim, is a controversial issue that deserves further study. In this connection,
can you give us the spelling of that French intelligence officer, 4445, who then was networking with Skorzeny? How was his last name spelled?
His full name is spelled J-E-A-N, Jean, last name Gardez, G-A-R-D-E-S.
Okay, thank you very much. Go ahead.
It should be pointed out that Waffen-SS and Wehrmacht veterans made up a substantial portion of the rank and file within the elite parachute regiments of the 5th Psychological Warfare Bureau in Algeria, the very units that were actively involved in military revolts in Algeria. It is also worth noting the existence of various direct and indirect personal links between Hitler's commando and elements implicated in later acts of neo-fascist terrorist violence. For one thing, one of the key activists working in Agentur Press, a press agency in Leipzig that served to disguise the activities of International Center of Right Subversion, was Robert Leroy, formerly an instructor at Skorzeny's School for Saboteurs. Another was Skorzeny's chief, reading again, another one of Skorzeny's chief patrons and associates in Spain was the Duke of Valencia, who was the principal shareholder in a bank which owned a company that was used as cover activities of the Estado de Liberação Portuguesa, or the Portuguese Liberation Army, the ELP. That's the one I referenced earlier, that General Antonio Spinola was the commander of. In this context, it may also be significant that General Antonio de Spinola, the titular leader of the Portuguese counter-revolutionary forces that created the ELP, received a visit from his representative arms trading company, Merix AG, in July of 1975. End quote.
Wow. Well, I mean, simply the temporal scope of the operations that you're talking about overlap, obviously. We're talking about things that stretch, you know, not surprising, from World War II through the 50s, the 60s, and right on up through 1975. We've got about 4 minutes left, Monty, so we're going to need to wrap up this show. We'll continue with this in the next in our next program.
Of course. In keeping with all of these, what can I say, this transatlantic outright fascist connections between, of course, as I pointed out, William F. Buckley with James Burnham, of course, with the OAS Charlemagne elements, with Otto Skorzeny and Robert Leroy backing the OAS, not intellectually, but financially and in structure and operations through the 5th psychological parachute elements that are operating in Algeria. With all of this, it has to be seen through the context, or I should say through the focal lens, that all of this has something to do with the anti-Castro elements that are operating with William Guy Bannister and the elements that surround Roy Frankhauser and the American Nazi Party, specifically through an organization called the World Union of National Socialists, which was founded by Sir Oswald Mosley and the head of the American Nazi Party in this time period, a former captain in the United States Navy Office of Naval Intelligence by the name of George Lincoln Rockwell.
That's a good stopping place, not because we're almost out of time. I want to just interject very briefly that one of Bannister's investigators, Maurice Brooks Gatlin, was not only the representative or the legal representative of George Lincoln Rockwell in the hate bus affair, but he also claims to have channeled a bunch of CIA money to OAS officers who were trying to overthrow de Gaulle. we'll continue with this in our next program.
But
we are out of time for all practical purposes. I want to stress to listeners there are other resources available. Do not fail to check the brilliant comments by Tara Fracto, our wonderful contributing editor. And all of the material that's available on the SpitfireList.com website. And there's also a flash drive of all of my life's work and a mini library of old anti-fascist books available. This concludes For the Record program number 1337. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 11. This is being recorded on July 27th of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.